revelation tonight. Message on the first day, the end of the Sabbath. I was in the Spirit on the Lord's day, and heard behind me a great voice as of a trumpet, saying, I am Alpha and Omega, first and last. And what thou seest, write in a book, and send it unto the seven churches which are in Asia, unto Ephesus, and unto Smyrna, unto Pergamos, unto Thyatira, and unto Sardis, and unto Philadelphia, and unto Laodicea. And I turned to see the voice that spake with me, and being turned, I saw seven golden candlesticks, and in the midst of the seven candlesticks, one like unto the Son of Man, clothed with a garment down to the foot, and girt about the path with a golden girdle. His head and his hairs were white like wool, as white as snow, and his eyes were as a flame of fire, and his feet like unto fire, as if they burned in a furnace, and his voice as the sound of many waters. And he had in his right hand seven stars, and out of his mouth went sharp two-edged sword, and his countenance was as the sun shineth in his strength. And when I saw him, I fell at his feet as dead, and he laid his right hand upon me, saying unto me, Fear not, I am the first and the last. For I am he that liveth and was dead, and behold, I am alive forevermore. And have the keys of hell and of death. Write the things which thou hast seen, and the things which are, and the things which shall be hereafter. The mystery of the seven stars which thou sawest in my right hand, and the seven golden candlesticks. The seven stars are the angels of the seven churches, and the seven candlesticks which thou sawest are the seven churches.
I thought we might be as well to begin with verse 10 or 9, as we rather hung away last night just dealt with that at the end of the meeting. It does give, I suppose, an introduction to this section that we are about to consider, the state in which John was found at this time, as we came the Spirit on the Lord's day, and hearing behind him this great voice as of a trumpet, suggesting probably the summons that called to attention to give it ear to these divine communications. I suppose just as the Lord in divine sovereignty and in administration as the one that had the right to give these commands, the point being that he is a servant of right state to acknowledge his command and to initiate it. And the voice in its communication saying to him that what he saw, the vision he's about, I suppose, to see, and the other visions on the other part of it, to write in a book and send it unto the seven churches which are in Asia.
Would there be any significance that this was announced on the Lord's day?
We know as distinct as you will know between the gate of the Lord, which I do not doubt is the outstanding feature of this very book, the circumstances that will precede and ultimately bring in the gate of the Lord, which is of course the book to come. But I do not doubt that the Lord's day as we know it today, the first day of the week, when of course we begin with the remembrance of the Lord and a day which I trust we hold particularly in the region of the Lord's interest in this world. And it was that day selected to give this vision.
This is, I think, the only mention of the Lord's day.
I think this is the only place that I'm aware of. And being the Lord's Day, that is a divine authority with it. I know not else in the Lordship of Christ. Also, sometimes being said that if the Lord's Day mentioned here is not the Lord's Day that we hold today, which other day of the week would you call Lord's Day if it is not the first day of the week?
Do you think that this thought of the voice being behind John could suggest that sometimes we may get a communication or a message from a source other than directly in front of us in an unexpected way? I don't know if you follow what I mean, but naturally one would have thought that the voice would have come from in front of John, but we are told it came from behind him.
Would it not be covered in a verse we hope to read in verse 19? The things which thou hast seen, it was a backward look. The things which are, was what he must have seen to the 7th centuries. That were drawn from chapters 2 and 3, of course. And the things which shall be after these from chapter 4 to the end of the book. It's a backward look that John has given to see, which I believe involves the Lord himself in the decision. Prepare to write in these divine communications to the 7th assembly. I wondered myself about that. Would it be that he's given the look back, that he may be reminded and remind the 7th assembly the Lord has ever been this at any time in the history of the church, past, present, or future? The Lord has ever been in this character. These things have always been for him, past, present, and future. For as you well know, John, of course, having company with the Lord, when he was in this world, had never seen him in a judicial character like this, but it was told him nevertheless.
We have had a thought, perhaps, looking behind. Next verse, so he says, I told him to see the voice. And what he told him, it was seen to me that he's back upon the assemblies. He saw these seven candlesticks behind him, and the Lord in the midst. It's not a possible thought that in the condition in which we're going to find them, we may get tired and we may cease to look upon these assemblies and perhaps get our eye upon the glories of the kingdom to come. But as I look behind them, I find the Lord still there in the midst of the assemblies, and the Lord is there. I'm still there.
Oh yes, I do not doubt this is your heart, we said. For while time would not permit, in looking at the addresses of every one of these assemblies, some one or other of these features are presented to every one of them. It's what he is, the unchangeable Lord, that whatever the assembly, as we find to suggest last night, may be in privilege, and all that we've been brought into, again, just to remind ourselves, should seem given responsibility.
Yes.
And hence the Lord, not so much as a priest, in drawing us near to God, but rather in the character of a judge. And they talk to our circumstances of our walk in this world. I don't know if that's what it said.
Do you not think also that as a trumpet and great voice, so personal, and there seems to be distance, there seems to be that commanding power, trumpet, near voice?
A voice always displays who the person is. The voice of the Son of God, for instance, is life giving. The proof of who this person is, for in him is life. You know yourself often you hear someone's voice before you see them, and you know them by the voice. And I believe that's true by the Lord himself. We are capable of knowing that it is in his voice when he speaks to us. And that's what John is to find out here.
Before we get too far away from the reference to the Spirit, remember in the Gospels, in the Gospel of John, the Lord makes mention of the function of the Spirit, yes, to teach you all things as present and life. bring all things to your remembrance, as past, and show you things to come, what is future, as I bring that to you.
It is, the very yes. I'd always thought here, Mr. Davidson, that being in the spirit of this way meant that John was held and controlled and characterized by the spirit at this precise moment today.
I don't know if anyone could understand one of these details at all apart from the spirit. It's a revelation that the Lord gives himself, but I think we know that on our side. If it were not for the Spirit of God, we'd be incapable of taking it in. And that John, as we just hastily said last night, apparently was in the right state at that moment of reception of this revelation. But if he needed the Spirit in order to communicate it, we certainly need the Spirit to be able to understand it. And thank God we have the Spirit. However little we may think that we do know about the Spirit.
Everything in Christianity really stands in the Spirit.
Oh yes, it's the Spirit's day.
What you just said is that it is borne out by the reference in chapter 4. For when he begins to see some communication to this world, that is, John the Church, he deems his mention as being in the Spirit as well.
Four times I think that said in this book that he was in the Spirit. Paul wasn't on the one hand to say the judgment of Babylon, and on the other, the Holy City of all its glory. I think if I remember right, four times he said to be in the Spirit. And I think that's worth emphasizing. I want to think we've got so used with these terms that the power of the Mary also, you know, is worth emphasizing that if I am right in the name, these divine communications, it can only be in the power of the Spirit of God. A rightful state, I should suggest, every one of our souls.
Would it be right to say, Mr. Davidson, that we who have the Spirit, we might not always be in the Spirit?
That's right.
That's not a contradiction, but that is what we are saying, isn't it?
That's right. We suggested last night that once that he was in the right spiritual state to see this revelation. But now it's said that we saw not so much on John's own line of thinking, rather strikingly, it's a review of the holy apostolic ministry, the churches that had been brought to light in Asia. I think someone suggested last night the word that Paul wrote to Timothy, that all they would be in Asia are turned away from me. And he quotes a few Hymenaeus and Philetus and such like. And it may be because of this tendency to turn away from the truth that these letters are addressed to them. Mark, you, I think, where you've rightly learned, it describes the churches this way, right up to the time of the Lord's coming. For he speaks of his coming and the addresses of the seven assemblies. But while there are seven individual churches, it seems as though their state was such, they can be used by the Lord to describe the state of the assembly and its constant history in this world under his arms.
Is it correct that whilst the personal message or letter was sent to each assembly, in fact the whole of this group of revelation was sent to each?
It certainly was, therefore, that for every one of them, the whole of the seven assemblies.
But the whole character of this delineation of the history of the assembly as a responsible cause here then gives us at the outset a prophetic view of this testimony, doesn't it?
That's right. The history of it that we hope, as we do tomorrow night, particularly in the rest of Ephesus, I think it's there we see the reason of these seven assemblies being selected. But as our brother has just said, it certainly meant that the whole of this book was sent to every one of these assemblies with a view to them realizing the presence of the Lord in this judicial character and the end that was in view of the coming day of glory to which they were going. In order to recall them, once more they were reconciled.
It's a great encouragement to us, isn't it, to know that the Lord knew what was coming at us,
right? That's right, that is an endorsement. You know, sing again sometimes, I know not what's before me, God kindly veils my eyes. It could be the truth of that, you know. If I knew there was some disaster going to strike me next week, what about that? I'm not happy to get along, eh? No, but God very graciously, he will have these things, but now that he's ascended with a unity government, a wonderful defending of everything here before it happens.
How do you like the seven spirits? Seven assemblies, seven seals. In what sense then the seven? Other than it's a total view of the church's responsible history here.
Well, whenever you get the term seven, I think it was said last night, it's a number of divine perfection. Used in the church is typically of divine perfection.
These were not the only assemblies in Asia, were they? There were more than these, but these were selected.
That's right.
For the special purpose.
And it's on. The state that was there was apt enough like the parables of Matthew 13 that the Lord used. The state was here to use them to might be parabolically of the state of the whole assembly. Not mind you that they were parables, I mean, not right. Just the right state to describe the condition of the church of God.
In what sense do the seven churches here demonstrate divine perfection?
Well, that's why we said it's the complete history of the church, from the formation of the Father Spirit to the Lord's coming, that will bring the testimony of the church to an end. Only what is left, of course, will come under judgment. What is truly is will have left this world. But anyway, if we don't come down to that, we'll finish this chapter tonight. Most of us, I do not know that we've spoken of these days. We are writing on with an Ephesus as a word that means desire. Smyrna, murder, indicative of suffering. Pergamos, a marriage. Thyatira, a testicle. Sardis, a storm. Philadelphia, brotherly love. And Laodicea, people's rights. I'm sure we've heard these things often at the meetings. And they describe, as I hope we shall see at least in two of them, why the Lord used these assemblies. But now John's attention is, he turned to see the voice that spake to him. And instead of seeing the Lord, first of all, he sees these seven golden candlesticks. But I notice Mr. Darby every time renders that word marks. Seven golden lamps.
Has it reference to the candlestick of the Holy Communion?
Well, there again, Mr. Darby, I think again, whether it's not the lampstand of the Holy Place. Yes, I do not doubt it speaks of the anointed vessel, capable of shedding divine light on behalf of God in this world. You know, we talked about the privilege of these things. But your father may say again about the sanctuary we are reading, it's the responsibility of it that is brought before us. Am I, as one individual, expected to be a spiritual lamp in this world, shedding forth light and the testimony in relation to God? That's perfectly true of every one of us as of these seven assemblies.
Is that how it speaks of golden candlesticks in relation to God?
I believe it is. We know that, haven't we, that in the tabernacle you get gold in certain of the instruments, in certain of the letters. But pure gold is also mentioned there, that we rather think it is indicative of the where first but the gold is that which is divine. And let us remember again that something that is divine in every one of our souls, I am capable of manifesting what is of God in my life. I'm only using myself, of course, as a picture, it shows that it wants. You know, I fear we forget that. Many a name of this world, and where we don't like the name of certain things, just forgetting that after all, my daily position in this world is to be a lamp, shining out the divine light in every circumstance in which I am about. There's the most testing thing that we have in mind.
Sometimes we feel good after the speaker procession. If God has given to us all things and pertaining unto life and numbness. We can't get over it.
I saw last night that you have made a kingdom of priests. Well, I think this monastery certainly belonged to the holy place, we know that. Not the most holy place, as you will know, the holy place, which does speak of the presence of God, where the service of God, that's the word I call it, where the service of God is carried on. The lampstand, you remember, and the table of showbread, and the altar of incense were all there, where the service of God is carried out. And I believe, you know, that it's in that spirit that you and I ought to be moving in this world. I can't show this world what is in the most holy place. I can only realize that by the Spirit when I come here to God. And I ought to be able to show this world what is in the holy place as one who is connected with it as a priest. And able to demonstrate it before my fellow men. You know, at least one with this impression to see how much of God do my neighbours and the town in which I live, how much of God do they see in me? That's the series of my thing about it.
It says among whom he shines is light.
Well, I think that's the very obvious. But I seem to miss this grace that afterwards in the holy place, you see, it's only what is heavenly. If it's not the immediate presence of God, the holy place, it's certainly what is heavenly. And here I am, as we say, able to shine heavenly light in this world on behalf of God.
But in this setting here, it's the collective responsibility of seven assemblies.
I quite agree with that, but I'm just afraid that unless we get lost in the crowd, you know.
In every assembly, there's the overcomer, isn't it?
Well, there's the overcomer in an embassy. I quite agree what has been said, it's the whole assembly. But then what is mine? In relation to it. I'm not the assembly. I thank God I belong to it. But as one individual that ought to be seen in me, what is called for in the whole assembly? And of course, if I'm going to fail at it, and you're going to fail at it, there's only the no assembly testimony at all.
It's another testimony of an individual.
It's bound to me.
And it just says to him, the whole of your power. And so to say, it's interesting with regard to Mr. Stevenson's remark that shining his lights. That word you probably know is only used twice. Once in connection with the New Jerusalem, shining.
That's right.
And the scripture the brother has quoted.
Yes, and I remember that now that he called it to mind, but I had not opened it.
Yes.
That's why you saw what he said. What a wonderful thing then that is often being the two things put together, that I can shine on now what is going to shine on in the world to come.
Yes.
As John was the one who on the shores of Galilee was able to discern that it was the Lord that he saw, why is it that here it's one like the Son of Man, as though he wasn't sure?
We said you remember about him, and we have a little good deal to say about that in this section, Muzzle, that he has a character that he now sees the Lord in that he never seen before. Whatever else he had seen when he moved with the Lord, he was something that extra, we might say, that he now sees in regard to the public testimony in this world. We have a little more to say about that as we go down. Well, we hope to refer to that as a matter of fact. Those things that you've mentioned, we find them here on the page.
Yes.
I don't know if you've noticed in John's reading that he was lying on the bosom of Jesus when Peter motioned to him, the Lord said, one of you shall betray me. But it very strikingly says, lying upon the breast of Jesus, said Lord, who is it? The bosom is down here, they come from the whole place. He was lying in the lap of the Lord, as we would call it today, reclining at the table. But he lifted his head from the lap of the breast, and I believe the Lord whispered to John who it was, and I believe there's only one in that company that knew who it was. The Lord said he lifted the lid. The lap I think of when it's in a hollow place, the lap is the place of affection, and I believe the breast is the place of intimacy, where we learn things that we couldn't learn anywhere else. And now here it is, John. doesn't say they faced Son of Man, and I don't think the Lord exhibits the character of the Son of Man to the assembly, but it's what of that character that has seen him on life. I understand the reason it says life. We know, of course, that he is the Son of Man. But that has to do with worldly pomp and dominion in the world to come. Heaven says he is upon that character who's going to judge all things. He's on that character of the judge is now in the midst of the seven assemblies. Life, the Son of Man.
We usually think of the assembly, but not think of the Lord as the Son of God.
Oh, yes. Oh,
I hear the Son of Man.
That's right.
Is it because of this judicial character in the people?
Yes. That's why I heard that sign as we said, we sometimes know so much, you know, when we go to a passage like this. I prefer to speak of him as the Son of God. And so he is to them, oh yes, yes, but I love the face, since he does the Son of Man in the midst of the assembly and as well. That's the other side of the question.
So the phrase Son of Man means more than merely a person in human form.
That's why it speaks of universal dominion, you see, and the Son of Man is head over all things. But there it is to the assembly what I'm quoting. But all things are in his hand, in heaven and earth. And the Son of Man is Lord of all that will come to life manifestly in the world to come.
You say that was a sign, right?
That's right, and that is mine.
It's been the widest title that our Lord has.
How is it that the prophet Ezekiel in particular often takes hold of these words, Son of Man?
Yes. There again, the people has to learn that to see. I don't know how the term that he uses there carries the same thought. Because as you know, it's a judgment from God that comes to life in the prophecy of Ezekiel because of the Lord's sake of the people. And hence he's regarded himself as Son of Man, the Son of Man. The mark of the term is different in the Hebrew to what we have in the Greek.
There's sometimes in the Gospel John, rejected as Messiah, he takes the title Son of Man.
That's why you're right, glory. They said to him, this Son of Man, who is this Son of Man? They just wouldn't understand it. But I think we need to take care here, it doesn't say he is the Son of Man, but at the moment, he's seen in that character.
Are there two sides then to this Son of Man?
What are you going on?
Well, the Son of Man has come to seek and save.
Oh, well, yes, that's right. Taking that term again as this thing from the Messiah, I use that one that where the Son of Man shows him as Lord of the whole, it shows him the one that's available to all. The Son of Man has come to seek and to save. That was his loss. Wonderful is that the term is used in both ways.
Same person then would be the Savior and also be the judge.
I think that's the point of it. That's right. That's right. And so in that character, clothed with the garment down to the foot, it might be suggested to the priestly garment, like the garment that Aaron wore, clothed with the garment down to the foot. But another interesting point comes to light here. Get about the patch with a golden girdle. Looking up this word patch, it is not the word used for the breast somewhere, it's the word used for the female breast. Striking then that use of the Lord here. You remember the Lord, well, at least he spoke about it, that the day would come when they all his temple and said to the Lord, blessed thou the womb that bear thee and the patch that thou hast set. That's the word. It's a female breast. And my reason for just pointing that out, not as you know, we pick up these things from concordances. My reason for pointing it out is, it's sometimes being said about this, that his affections are from the restraint. But since I found out that the female breast is used of the Lord, I believe it's his resources that are on the restraint. I never came for the Lord, though I couldn't say anything against it when I heard it. That his affection was under his faith, I don't think that ever will be. But I can quite say it for you, the state of the assembly, is that resources in the under his faith.
As many as
before me as low as things might. Yes, there it is, you see, even as you say the latest here, as many as I love.
But have been of the thoughts of the judgment that it was based upon divine faithfulness.
That's right, I'm sure it is.
Divine love being kept about the thoughts.
You know, the Lord will not let me do as I like, and the reason he won't is because he loves me. You know, if I have a that, if I love them do it, I'm not going to let them do what they like. My love won't allow it. And that's what I think we said about these things, you see. His love is never under restraint, but his responses are. His love is too much to help us on our own path, if we can put it in there. And that's what I understood by this. And the day is coming up perfectly sure of this, but we thank the Lord for it. I believe we have to us, that might have not wrong ideas all of us. Desire that we can to be women allowed to carry out. I think the day has come when we find that the Lord and his love to us didn't give us the power to carry it out.
So there's a very touching rebuke in this, that if we're moving subject to the Lord's guidance of the Spirit, there's always resources.
That is under divine restraint because the Lord can then punish us on what is wrong, much as he loves. Now, if you look it up, past half an hour and we have done, you'll find, as I said, it's a word that is used for the female breast and not merely the boy that is here who may have a breast.
There is obviously the leading thing. That's why many have said that the Almighty God may well be spoken of as the all sufficient God.
Right.
It's a resource for the building.
That's what it is. Mm. Then he said, and he said, quite like the whole, again, as being pointed out, that would suggest the purity of divine wisdom. From away, using the character of the whole, you remember that's used in other places about the Lord. Does it suggest, as I thought it does, natural purity? Difficult word to say about the Lord. What I mean, it wasn't dyed white or washed white. It was naturally white. The purity of divine wisdom. You and I have to be corrected sometimes in these things. The Lord never does.
Those things would be as full. Because wool was the very clean, as far as I could see. This verse, when I read it, indicates that the wool, apparently in that day, was as white as snow.
Yes.
Because it's the wool that is defined, isn't it?
That's right. And that's why we suggest, you see, that, well, at least when it's washed, it comes out beautifully white, you know. And I think that's why it was used. That it was, as we said, naturally white and undying white. The Lord has to communicate these things to make it as I don't possess them. But nobody can communicate them to him because he doesn't possess them.
The same characteristics here described by the seer, Daniel also saw in the ancient of days.
Yes.
So there is that which is suggested as the divine divinity in wisdom.
That's right. Both in his head and his head, the head would be the source of this wisdom, and perhaps a suggestion of the head, the different character in which this wisdom was displayed, springing from that head. And then eyes like a flame of fire, again suggests about this piercing, penetrating look, that we know there is no creature hidden from his eyes.
Standing with the judge, this would be absolutely necessary.
It would.
Both wisdom and purity.
That's right. You probably heard that read the fact about the preacher that wanted to go to an opera or somewhere and ask if there was any joy to get in without his congregation seeing him. And the reply of the stage manager, whoever he was, said that was, there wasn't any joy in the theater that God couldn't see go. I don't know how that is then. You might have seen a track, I've seen it often in the gospel track. But that's the idea here, that something that we cannot escape. Wherever we are at all times, let us never forget the Lord's eyes upon us. I may love you, all right, and it was the Lord. So you wait a minute.
It's extraordinary, and that character, that's what you will see like me.
So it says, you have
all that's hidden behind his eyes, there was a thing on fire even now. Nothing in him.
All right.
It goes up.
Yes.
It could be the filter on everything.
Oh, that's what he might have said. But only thing I don't hear that is judicial character, and you are correct in what was going wrong. But if you say certain that there's every comfort to be taken from the fact that when we require desire, it is the devil that he wants. And he says that too. Oh, yes. And then he speaks like unto fine glass. There's a gift and a cause of the law in this world. Not that the Lord was walking in this world, but the pathway that he had come. Now here you see, as if they burn in a furnace, it seems to be against the gist of a practical righteousness passing through the fire.
It emphasizes that the Lord himself was a servant overcome in this world when we are called upon to their testimony.
And isn't it nice to think in a simple way that he doesn't ask us to do anything he didn't do it himself when he was here? That is an accomplishing of the will of God, of course. Tempted in all points like it as we are, passing through the same circumstances, never fail in the accomplishing of the will of God.
Would be fired, is defiled in the profession of Christianity tonight. He shall never be defiled by that, will he?
No. And I do not doubt, will you say this, but it is to be sent to the cell in the same place. If his feet are like this, speak like unrefined glass as a burden of confess. Don't you think the reception of that on my part would be the walk of that way that is in line with this?
I've read somewhere that it's represented as yielding judgment. No grace in whatsoever. What would you say to that?
Well, there again, we have to be careful with these things. No grace in religion to what is wrong, that is perfectly true.
I mean, you've got
to. Oh, yes, I believe that's perfectly true. How could we spare what is wrong? But if there is wrong to the popularity of the maintenance of what's right, and the effect it ought to have upon us is brass, of course, which speaks of righteousness. It's not silver at all, it's brass. And then the voice of the sound of many waters, we hear many things about these, irresistible might has been said about this, but it's many waters. It may suggest that his voice comes in many distinctive ways to us, with divine authority and power behind every divine communication.
Majesty.
Yes, His Majesty, I do not doubt.
You take one psalm, the voice of every verse in speaking the verse of the voice of the Lord.
That's right, great the proceeders, etc.
Well, you are His Majesty in His place.
But then, in His right hand, John sees these seven stars, and he's stolen a little bit further down, represent the angels of the seven assemblies. I think one of the most helpful things ever pointed out about this that I heard was that stars only shine in darkness. You don't see them in the day. As though to indicate that there are those capable of shedding divine light in the midst of this dark world of which we know. As being said, the sun, moon, and stars, of course, come in later in this book. They're mentioned in the Old Testament too, with Joseph's dream, you remember. The sun, in effect, the sun is mentioned here. Supremacy, as the thought in the sun. In the moon, we get generated light. I think we're right in assuming it reflects the light of the sun, but it consolidated upon it. But the stars, I believe, are individual, representative of God in the midst of the darkness. When Abraham received promise from God, you remember, the first thing God told him was his seed would be in the dust of the earth. But in chapter 22, I think, in the afternoon of that day, he had the second one. That his seed would be as a serpent. And then ultimately he had the third one, that his seed would be as a sand upon the sea shore. And I don't know how to represent both the heavenly company, that is in the stars, Israel in the dust, and the Gentile nations of the sand. One confirmation of that previous, I think, somewhat upon lately, is in this very book, God and Magog at the end of the world to come. Gathers together the nations of the sand upon the sea shore. Not as the dust, but as the sand. And I believe it's the aggregate of apostate worldwide, and we say Gentile nations, the aggregate in apostasy at the end of the kingdom. Sand upon the sea shore. The Lord, of course, was on the sand of the seashore when he opened up the principles of the kingdom. What is the people for?
In the sixth chapter, it says, and the stars of heaven,
that's right,
fell into the earth.
That's right. Those who represent and make heavenly luminaries passed down to the earth.
What did they do? What was that represent?
Well, I think it is all that, well, whether the Christian, probably an apostate Christendom, supposed to be leaders in giving heavenly life, the church has gone by the Romans, and they're all subject to the worship of the beast and the Antichrist. They fall from heaven. No longer give heavenly life.
Speech of power, isn't it?
Huh?
It speaks of power.
Oh, yes. Well, it does in a way, but I do not know that the leaders of Christendom refer to that, the apostate leaders. But these seven stars are in his right hand. There's a place of administration where the Lord is the fourth and in that administration. That is, if they're going on with what is right, he's quite capable of supporting them in what is right. If, on the other hand, he has to very severely condemn what is wrong.
Do these represent then some particular person?
They do. Well, it says so. Under the angel of the church in Ephesus, it's mentioned in relation to the whole seven assemblies. Whether it may be more than one individual, it probably is. Speaking of probably, one can always suggest this, of the responsible element in each of these assemblies.
Are we not all responsible here?
Well, yes, we are. But I think you'll know very quickly. Some of the meeting comments on this suggesting this, there are certain ones that we regard as carrying the responsibility probably more than others. It may be that. But you see, what we begin with is the angel at the beginning and the overcomer at the end.
Yes.
And again, we all know about the overcomer at the end. Well, yes, there's a reference to it, I do not know. Why? Certainly we're all responsible. But I think we instinctively feel as, well, of course, we're bringing to a local assembly. That was certain local element in the name that we regard as being responsible for the state of that assembly.
It's a subtle.
Well, it is. You see, that as we said, it's one thing to want to seek. Oh, yeah, I don't know about that word. It's one thing to be in the place of leadership and the privilege in that. But look at the responsibility connected with it. That's the thing I think we're going to regard here.
The angel here is the vehicle, isn't it, of the message to John in the Spirit to the assembly.
I think so.
And therefore, in that respect, he would have to be a responsible person in that.
I think so. I think the elders, as our brother has pointed out, that would be responsible for the assembly. But then out of his mouth, a sharp two-edged sword. We looked up this word when we were thinking about this passage, and there's only one other place outside of Revelation that that is used. It's in Luke 2, the sword shall pierce through thy heart. One sword, is it?
Yes.
Also, sword, is it? Yes, also. That's the only other place, I think, outside of Revelation that the sharp two-edged sword is used. That is this word right there, for this two-edged sword. But we know that to us, this is a clear word to us, a reference to Hebrew 4, that the word of God is quick and powerful, and sharper than any two-edged sword. Well, just the distinction between the word used for sword and a piercing sword that would be a death thrust. Because Hebrew says, you remember, dividing it someday between sword and spirit, joints and marrow. And as a devil, of course, an intent of the heart. And wouldn't the thumb pay here in this word coming out of the mouth of the Lord not a piercing sword to slay, but a sword that will divide between what is right in his estimation and what is wrong? And as I said, Hebrews more naturally would be an explanation of this for us.
Well, that's what I have thought, that's why I want to point the book.
Well, I find that there's a different word for sort of Hebrews, though it does say a two-edged sword. Unless I made a mistake. That's why it's a different word for sword. But the terms are used nevertheless there.
Yeah, it's very interesting.
Yes. Obviously, the word of God coming out from his mouth.
I remember looking at John 4, sharp-edged sword, and
Hebrews 4,
a such a scalpel.
Okay. There, that's right.
The Bible is not so much slain.
No, that's right. It's dividing.
Is the point here not that the judgment will surely be executed? It's the execution of the judgment.
I think it's the administration of it that is coming out here, but not so much to slay as to correct, as what I'm trying to suggest, on the two edges.
But when you come to the surely the judgment will be carried to its fullest extent.
But that's a little bit for salt there, that's why we're bringing up the distinction. To show that that word is so used there, get thy sword upon thy thigh, etc. It's not the same sword as used here.
Well, then, does this stop the church going on?
For us, it certainly stops at the church in this section. But we get further on in Revelation and other connections.
What I was thinking was that a certain man has seen here not only in connection with the church, but he's also in connection with the kingdom.
Well, that's true, but I don't know. But what I think we can see from this is that his word coming out is of my character. Not to slay us, but to show us quite clearly what is of himself and what is not of himself. That when I accept his word, I will worry for him on the Well, yes, he's the one that can do that in his lordship. We accept what our Lord will accept it from him. As far as what we're reading here, definitely for the seventh century. I'm only saying that that word was sort of used again further on in this book, but not in relation to the seventh century.
It's not how much you are in the English here, but the book, where you're from.
I was, yes.
Well, you'll get to see it, and after that, you get it.
Well, the same person,
isn't it? Oh, it's the same person.
It's the same attitude, really.
Oh, yes, quite. Well, French had looked the word up and used them more than one occasion in this book. But the character of the thing is what was here, the dividing is somewhere, and that's why we call it Hebrews. It's not a piercing sword, it's a dividing sword. And it's a word of his mouth that will ruthlessly condemn everything that's not according to his mind, and on the other hand, will clearly show that it is. And of course for us, we don't need to know all the wrong things in the world to keep going right. We need to know the right things. I remember in the Midlands of Brother Hope, I'm sorry to say, it was a great trouble at the Bible readings, and questioned something that's a wholesale, not very well the reading was, it wasn't here. It was never said in the Bible. That was what he said. And Mr. Hope said, oh, what do you think about it? See, he said, if you say a thing is not in the Bible, it means that you know it because it's in the Bible. But if you say a thing is in the Bible, you only need one verse, much safer than that. And that's okay. I was in the reading. It wasn't me, mind you, but I appreciated what he said. I wasn't me. It was a brother in the Bible. He's talking about that. that was a very good sin. You need not and we say, oh, there's no one as many here, as long as you're sure of what it's for.
Yeah, I wouldn't expect you to be a child in the ring.
Oh, well, it's I don't know, but anyway, it wasn't big enough. And then so his countenance of the sun shineth in its strength. I think we can easily discern the strongest of all lights with status of faith and authority in that what I'm saying in the hands of the Lord, though with his countenance shine. So on the Mount of Transfiguration, you remember, and you will see to it.
The Lord be glory.
Oh, I don't know that supremacy in that glory. Just as the Son is supreme among these heavenly ones. But now he says, when I saw him, I fell at his feet as dead. As we said, our brother just anticipated this a little bit. Then on the breast, or on the lap of Jesus, as we would speak of it, and then on the breast of Jesus in intimacy, now he's found at his feet, but he's saying, on the character of his life.
What we have that follows in this book of judgment.
How wonderful when we can say the terrible things that God has burst upon this world in the judgment of God and not be afraid of them. You know, John, and the older I get, the more I begin to think, I've accepted these things for so many years without really seeing them any moment.
Well, when we saw Hitler and Mussolini, it did give us comfort to know that even they, in their little way, compared with what is yet to be, even lived. And the first, the last one.
He saw him and his feet is dead, and he sees the justice, not in the world, but in the midst of the seven sins.
That's right.
You might give it to Judy Fields?
Well, now that's what I'm trying to say. Several things today, and we forget in this character of the Lord today, and we perhaps lived so much on the side of privilege that we're just a little bit careless about responsibility. I can see it written in there, all the meetings I'm going to do it. I don't want to say that to make anybody's degrees. They know some of us the same heaven when we look back, when we first came to the meetings 40 years ago, compared with what we see in the meetings today, as we're slipping away on the ground of responsibility and boasting about the privilege. And sure, when we meet the Lord and his judgment seat, that's the thing I'm sure the Lord will give us the reward for and commendation. And on the line of Christian responsibility, we have a pastoral thing that we do today.
Well, often feels that in ministry we are being taught that unless privilege is overemphasized, we are no longer too responsible. I don't think this is right. Why do you live in a book like this?
No, that's right. I think you agree, of course, now we have been trying to suggest we must hold these things in balance.
In balance, yes.
I certainly appreciate the wrong of privilege, but I must hold to this wrong of responsibility whenever it's to the other side, that I'm most responsible.
In what we will receive in the appearing, we will be there because of the position we get will be how we have served, right, the appearing.
If we took the parable that the Lord himself gave about, if you remember, well done, thou good and faithful servant. That's what the Lord is looking for today.
When Paul refers to the crown, it's the appearing. Now, to me, hopefully, but for those also who love his appearing, they will.
And there again, as in Timothy, that comes in, isn't it?
Yes.
Where the ground of Christian responsibility is so much stress. If we get no more out of these readings than the sense of what is due to the Lord, and what I am capable of rendering to him in answer to this, and say, give it grace from him that I might have to do it, these readings will not be in vain. That was really the thought that was in one's mind when we brought the Lord Christ among them. I suppose the first and the last again are divine titles. There was none before him, and none can possibly come after him. He's the embodiment of every, or I know he said every divine movement, but that's the beginning again. The first and the last of the eternal universe.
Like if you're full of it, you're full of my sin.
It is, that's right.
Amen.
Right.
as you mentioned at the beginning of this description, that his garment would probably be indicative of priesthood. Would you say that this would be the Melchizedek priesthood without the beginning of the years and without the end of the year?
Well, I would love to say something more about that priestly condition, but we slipped away from it. There again, the priest not only brought what was due to God's garment, he was the priest of whom the Lord God remembered. And you'll find in the Old Testament cases for judgment were brought to the high priest, and he was supposed to come to the judgment about them, two sides of the priesthood. And it's remembered Sinai that we suggested that I think comes in here. A life forevermore. In chapter 3, I think it ought to be then from fear of death and of Hades, the state that is after death.
In the words and
say what, Michael?
In the words and was there, the fact that the very words that the saints of God has invested in this word,
right,
which is in the hands of man, is death.
That's right.
But the Lord is being divided.
It is. Fear none of those things that thou wilt suffer, he has to say to one of them. I'm sure it is.
That's just himself. Just remember, in the time of martyrdom, Father Christopher upheld them, facing martyrdom, and having to present themselves, so he became dead, doesn't
he? As he became dead, yes. And as a light forevermore. Another thought, of course, as we've said, it's nothing new to speak about it. There is another life after this life. And the Lord wants us to remember that. That's the life we ought to be. Keep in mind and live in relation to it.
Could you say something about the word decay and what it is called? Not was dead. We know that the Lord was dead, but he says decay be dead.
I said your translation, maybe, doesn't it? Became dead. I thought it was laid behind the cross. He went through that of his own volition. Not only that man put him to death, but he went through it of his own volition.
Quite apart from that altogether.
That's right. That he might destroy it entirely on his own.
Your man put him to
death. Well, I've already done it myself. The word has been on it. I have authority to lay it down, and I have authority to take it again. There's authority. I think it might be so like in us, perhaps the thing that we could fear most has been put to death because of the testimony. Well, the Lord was, but he's alive forevermore.
It's the greatest enemy.
Well, if it is the last enemy to be destroyed, it's good to tell us. That's right.
Even that is in only as far as man is. Fear not them who are able to
destroy.
And maybe, that is, he doesn't only control this, will he control the next? Though that's not quite a good statement, because it's an intermediate state so far as the saints are concerned. And he, so far as anybody's concerned, Hades is not the final judgment of God. Gehenna is the word used, and the lake of fire. It's the state after death that he controls things, we might say, this side of death, and he controls it on the other side of death. He has a case, he's in control of it all.
And there's getting to the state through which both the sinner and the saint.
Oh yes, I think so.
It's a condition.
It's a condition of the body absent from the spirit absent from the body. It's more a condition than a place, as we said. For you remember in Luke 16 when the Lord mentioned it, in Haiti he lifted up his eyes to him in torment.
It's just those who unsaved, isn't it?
Oh yes.
It's not saved, it's just
concerned. Oh, no, about that.
No difference in the condition.
Not as to the physical condition, all that's true. Our spirits and souls leave our body just as an unconverted person will level. Our death. And that's why he brought in the 15th of 1 Corinthians. O death, where is thy sting? O Hades, where is thy power? So that's from the right way on. That's what Paul said, you see. And so now this is broken up. I say we're trying to talk it a little fast. We have to let the book is right, but not very good. It's like the things which thou hast seen, I suppose that's the vision. The things which are, would be the next two chapters in regard to the 7% faith, and the things which shall be hereafter, probably on some chapter 4 of the end of the book, looking on to the future. But now he speaks of the mystery of the seven stars, which thou sawest in my right hand. We might just say again, as we've often said, that the mystery is not something that's mysterious. It is something put out in a divine way that only God with divine power can understand. That's the thought of the mystery. There are 39 different mysteries in the New Testament, but you and I have the power to understand every one of them and minister to God. It's a mystery in the fact that man by his natural ability can't find it out. I'm getting the simple to say that God can find it out by the Spirit of God.
It is,
I'm called to say, it is one. And the seven lamps, I noticed, Mr. Darby, you were formerly when the six lamps, the lamps. The seven stars are the angels of the seven set place, and the seven lamps which thou sawest are the seven set place. One more word, as I think it's every time we were called, the Lord's in the midst. Have to be thankful for that. He's not on the other side, as it were, though he's outside of the last one we ever see there. But at the Father's view, generally